You're listening to Exploring Boys Education. This is the second part of the teacher-boy connection. If you haven't yet listened to part one, make sure to do that before diving in here. Let's pick up our conversation again with Peter Kutis and Sandy Boys where we left it. Sandy was highlighting the importance of supportive classroom environments.
When we provide that culture of predictability and support for the students in the class for our boys, then as a baseline, they feel that they all have the opportunity to be seen, heard, known, and loved by us.
You've both alluded to this, you know, this idea of high expectations, which is important. So the question I have in terms of creating this positive classroom environment for boys, how do we manage the tension between maintaining high expectations with fostering a supportive and inclusive atmosphere where boys feel comfortable taking risks, making mistakes, and the freedom to grow and maybe express that vulnerability that you were talking about, Peter?
Yeah, it seems all a bit paradoxical when you think of it. I think, though, when we set a high standard and hold boys to it, what they're seeing in that is that we value them enough to do the work, that we believe in them, and that we believe in their ability to improve and to learn. And to my mind, that's the currency of care for boys. And so with all of those things in place, including the relationships we've been talking about, we've then laid the groundwork, I believe, for a positive classroom environment. And that's an environment that amplifies the impact of any specific teaching strategy. Another thing from my perspective is that, you know, while we understand that our work with boys is serious and important business, which it is, we should never take ourselves too seriously. So when boys see that we can laugh at ourselves, that we're comfortable showing them our human side, that we can be appropriately vulnerable, and that on occasions we have the confidence and the wherewithal to just throw the curriculum out the window in pursuit of a teachable moment, when we're able to do those things, boys are more open to venturing beyond their comfort zone and more comfortable taking risks. And look, one practical strategy that I like to use with boys is this idea of a subject matter expert exercise, SME, following an assessment task. So what I do is I commission boys who have done particularly well in a certain area to assist others, to provide them with feedback in their area of strength, and to give them the authority to sign off on the corrections of their peers. And I generally find that most boys, if you do it that way, get a turn at playing the expert across the course of a school term, which is inclusive and great for their self-esteem. And believe me, they take their role as experts very, very seriously. And so rather than, you know, me standing at the front, going over a test or an exam, and at any point in time, talking, if I'm lucky, to 20% of the class who need to hear what I have to say. Rather, I've got boys working in groups with each other, reviewing their performance and being guided by a peer who's an expert, at least in that part of it. You know, again, if we can find ways to help boys feel valued, to be seen, then we're making progress.
Peter, I can hear people picking up their pens and pencils and writing that down, because I think that's going to be a huge takeaway from this. And I'm going to be one of the people taking that great idea away. So thank you for that. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for having a little bit of fun at the beginning of the class or an advisor group. I've and some of my peers have found this to be really great, particularly in an advisor mentor group situation. A small video, a funny story, a challenge game. I cannot believe how much this works in my group, but we have two sort of very dedicated mentor group times every weekly cadence. And we sort of say, you know, meaningful Mondays or like topical Tuesdays and then fun Fridays. And some of the leaders, the boys take turns being the leaders of what happens on the fun Friday, or at least at the beginning of the fun Friday. And things like, you know, who can recite the alphabet backwards, making the fewest mistakes, who can, you know, count back from 107s or 11s or something like that, gives them a lot of fun. Giving them mini chocolate bars and having them throw them into the garbage can from, you know, across a classroom and having it. You know, they start to create all the tiers of the who's going to win this, and the Division A is going to go against the Division B. They have the most fun. But mostly, what I'm hoping is happening is that we have multi-grade mentor groups. So the grade 9s, 10s, 11s, and 12s have the chance to really interact in a neutral way on a skill-based activity that evens the playing field for all of them, regardless of how old they are. And they really have fun interacting in that way. And then I sort of try to say, listen, where were the moments that you changed your strategy? Because if you ever do this one, if people want to try it, the alphabet backwards is a great one. And you can just see them all, like no pens, nobody can write anything down. Like then they start to call out all the rules, right? To see, because they're timing themselves to see how fast they've done it. And you sort of have this fun, engaged atmosphere, but they do begin to tweak their approach. And so at the end, I call out explicitly the moments of failure. Like, what was it, failure? You just changed your tactic. You tried something new. You changed your approach. You made this thing. You tried to see the alphabet in your head, whatever it was. But did you feel like, a failure because you didn't do it as quickly? Or how did you adapt your strategy? And then I try to make the analogy, look, it's not that much different from working along in a subject or a course and changing your tactic and trying something new. It's just a new approach. And why would you feel so differently about the alphabet challenge to, you know, something you're doing in a course? Well, you know, miss, it's being graded. Well, accept the fact and the fact that you are a part of that process and you get the chance to learn as well. So if you're making tweaks and changes, then that's a really important thing. So there seems to be this understanding that if we can help them understand when they're applying challenge to non-threatening chocolate bar challenges and understand that to sort of more real life situations, I think they see that we're on our side and maybe it isn't that different. It's just a nice little balance moment for them.
Sandy, I want to thank you for affirming my Freedom Friday that I used to have in my English class. If we'd met our goals for the week by the period on Thursday, we'd have Freedom Friday. But the trick was I actually always played word games with the boys. And so they were actually learning, but they really enjoyed that sort of different cadence. And, their commitments, I think, both through the relationship I'd built with them, but also their commitment to completing all we needed to complete by Thursday so that Friday could be a bit of fun. It brings me to the whole idea of school culture. We've spoken a lot about classroom and individual teachers engaging with boys, but how do we create school cultures that value and nurture these learning relationships?
Yeah, great question, Bruce. And that's been a key topic of discussion for our special interest group, in fact. And we've learned so much from each other in talking about that. And in fact, that was probably the core purpose originally, is how do we share the good things that are happening in different schools and in different contexts, and then try to contextualize that. So one element certainly is a willingness to be deliberate and intentional in that space. And then to go further on that point, you know, I think there are two fundamental and I think quite challenging elements of school cultures that value and nurture learning relationships with boys. The first one I'd point to there is an acceptance that no matter how long we've been teaching boys, no matter how naturally inclined we might be to teaching in a relational way, building positive learning relationships with boys is something that needs constant work. And that work is different each year because the boys in our care are different each year, and it's such an individual thing. There's also an acceptance in that and in those schools that the relational gestures themselves can be learned and applied by all teachers to improve the quality of their relationships. So we're not just talking here about, the innately gifted few. It's a belief in these schools that we can all get better at these things and that we can all learn them, no matter how long we've been doing it. And then those gestures, of course, not only do they improve our working alliances with boys, importantly, in my view, and as a result of those improved relationships, they also increase the degree to which we experience satisfaction and joy in our work. And when we're talking about teacher well-being, I think that's a key consideration. so much of what we feel and how we feel is dependent upon the quality or lack of quality of the relationships we have with boys. And for teachers that care deeply, which of course is all of us, you know, we take those things home with us. And so when we get that right, it actually flows on into better well-being, I believe. And then the second one for me at this point, I think we should highlight at least briefly, and that is that in schools that have this front of mind and have it as a prominent feature of all that they do, there's an acceptance that as the adults and the professionals in the room, we need to take responsibility for managing the learning relationships with the boys in our care. And that includes taking responsibility for repairing relationships with boys when they break down. If I go back to the original research done through the IBSC, you know, it's very clear on this point. Boys will generally not make the effort to meet us halfway, to do what we might consider is their fair share of the work required to mend a broken relationship with a teacher. And as a general rule, boys would actually rather not learn, would rather just fail than to do that. And that's challenging because it grates against our sense of justice and our natural inclination to think, hey, you know what, I've done all I can, now it's up to him. And then a corollary of that second element that I quite like is a belief in those schools that no boy is unreachable or unteachable. And these are really challenging concepts, but in my experience at least, they're crucial elements of the cultures that you're referring to.
You know, I really think those are important points, Peter, and I think within the culture that we are in right now where boys are in crisis, the work of Richard Reeves, you know, the work of Ruth Whitman, et cetera, we are understanding that it can be easy to say, listen, you should be meeting me halfway, young man, and maybe walk away. And yet we know now more than ever how devastating that could be to the situation and plight of our boys in the world to feel that we've given up on them, even though they might feel they shouldn't be working for us. So I think we need to just hold all of this very closely to our hearts right now and understand that boys more than ever need this relational approach and they need that care. I'm going to maybe shift to some of the spaces and structures in a school that support the guiding principles of, you know, learning relationships and school culture. Many academic institutions have some sort of mentor or advisory program in junior schools. Usually it's the form teacher. And as boys grow and mature, they're assigned to and choose adult mentors to guide them through those really important 12 to 18 year old years. Sometimes it can represent how a school has dedicated the time for these mentor groups. So do they have, has a school made time for community time, mentor group time, social time, free time, play time, downtime, et cetera. Having small groups navigate important conversations on challenging topics. So how a school chooses to organize that says a lot about its approach to, I think, relational learning. The existence says that if they have them, it says that they value relationships and they're actually programmed into the school day, which can be certainly easier said than done. But I think it's an important point. If you are a parent looking at a school and you wanted to see, does this school value the relationship with my son? I think you could look at how it's structured and how it's scheduled. Another thing you can look at is that show and demonstrate how a school culture is dedicated to valuing relationships is the evidence of the school's core values prominently displayed. Does it have a portrait of the graduate explaining key qualities they expect their boys to have, you know, upon leaving school into the global community, the kind of service learning opportunities that are provided for the boys to understand the world around them, you know, how a school culture describes its commitment to the tenets of diversity, inclusion, and belonging. These are all places for a school to celebrate and communicate its approach to a relational learning culture. And I think the more it is explicit about it being visible, the more likely teachers and students are to understand that that's part of the school culture.
I think I'd like to return to the work of the SIG, because this is a really important opportunity for schools around the world to get together and talk about these important things you've been sharing today. Are there some examples of some of the work done by the group to develop resources that support schools in their work to embed relational learning practices?
Thank you, Bruce. Thanks again for the question. Look, one of the things that we are quite proud of as a group is the work that we did in developing a professional conversation protocol that provides guidance, you know, a script, if you will, for teachers seeking to support a colleague who is experiencing a significant relational challenge with a boy or maybe a group of boys. Such occurrences are, of course, as we all understand, common. But as a group, we were concerned that there didn't exist a protocol that could be deployed in the moment, or at least in a time frame that was short enough to be practical in the context of a busy school. So we set about developing one together. And the protocol we came up with eventually was inspired by a longer form exercise frequently used in clinical practice, interestingly enough, but adapted to have the teacher-boy relationship and indeed the teacher at its centre. And it's designed to provide explicit guidance to a teacher who is looking to support a colleague in their moment of need. The protocol was discussed and, in fact, quite memorably role modelled by two of our group members at the 2022 conference at St. Mark's in Texas. And, look, we'd be really happy to share that with any of your listeners who might be interested.
Interestingly, the more meetings we had, some of the similar topics came up regardless of whether our SIG schools were in the world. And a lot of that was, how do you make relational learning live beyond understanding the gestures? So how do you translate moments of trying things and hoping they go well to how do you manage those moments of inevitable, as Reichardt would say, breakdown, and understanding that breakdowns are common and breakdowns are to be expected, and it's what you do with them that really is where the relational learning truly lives in your school. Another thing, Peter, you know, there's a huge emphasis on relational learning and teacher onboarding. I think people were very, very interested in how to bring new people, new staff members, new faculty members into their schools, and then sort of coach them up on the relational learning gestures and having them understand how important it was to their school culture. So I think schools in the SIG are generally looking for those structures, those protocols, those ways to really make it exist beyond understanding what the gestures are. And that those kinds of professional learning communities that schools have established, understanding that this work needs investment. It's great intention, great intuition, but it really needs to be embedded thoughtfully, practically. And I think we would all agree in some sort of the school needs to create a structure for those conversations in order for it to keep going. And one of the ways the SIG supported that was that people from schools would sort of be bringing back to their communities the things that we were talking about. And, well, how did St. David's do that? Or, you know, how did the other schools do it? And that was a really important thing. So having a SIG at all, or having a version of a SIG that's dedicated to relational learning in your school is a really important structure that was identified in our conversations.
I go back to the beginning of the conversation where I said one of the joys of being part of IBSC is being able to learn from people around the world. And both of you are so learned and knowledgeable, and I'm grateful for all that you've shared today. But I'd like to end with just some advice from both of you. You know, if you were to be addressing a teacher who is really passionate about connecting with their boys, but might feel possibly unsure or might want to know how to start or how to improve, what would your advice be as we close this wonderful conversation?
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. Let me start with what might sound like a slightly eccentric answer, but hopefully I'll pull it into something a little bit more mainstream towards the end. Look, I actually think that a good place to start when we're thinking about those things is to go back to reflecting on why we became teachers, and teachers of boys in particular. You know, for most of us, we became teachers because we enjoy working with young people, and we understand that our efforts can have a profound impact on the lives of individuals, families, and in some cases, whole communities. And we particularly enjoy the energy, drive, and humour of boys. And as an aside on that note, you know, the research on the question of why teachers choose the profession, I think, is interesting here, because two of the most important reasons given are altruism, that sense of wanting to make a difference, to contribute to a greater good, and affiliation, a desire to do important work as part of a community of like-minded people and to learn from and be supported by those people. And we generally don't have to look too hard if we undertake that exercise to see that we are making a positive difference on some boys at least, and that we are working in wonderfully supportive and dedicated professional communities in our schools. And I know that's true of Hale School where I am and many, many, many of the schools around the world that we're talking about. So I'd recommend a teacher starts with that reflection, as it can be strongly motivating and I think reassuring. And then on the how to improve part of it, I still can't go past the eight relational gestures as a place to begin. They were identified really clearly in the original IBSC research. There's good examples there. And they provide an excellent blueprint based on simple, actionable strategies that can be learned and applied by every teacher of boys. And as we've been saying, you know, as teachers, we can all do these things better if we devote time and effort to it. And as I've said earlier, I think when we are purposeful and intentional in the application of those gestures, we actually get better at building those relationships, irrespective of, you know, whether we've been teaching 10 years, 20 years, 30 years or 2 years. And then one final thought from me actually comes from the wisdom of Australia's First Nations peoples. The Noongar people of my home state here in WA have a word, kaya, which is generally translated as a greeting, as hello. But as was explained to me recently by an elder, it more accurately means I see you. And I love the wisdom of that. And I see it as enormously powerful as a construct for teachers of boys. Because if we're looking for a place to start, we could do a lot worse than making sure that each boy knows that we see him, not for who we want him to be, but for who he really is.
Peter, I think that you know, in addition to your other great gift to this conversation, I think people will be retelling that story, and for exactly those reasons. I don't think there's a boys' school in our network that isn't trying to make more visible the I see you moment, and the fact that there's actually an Indigenous a tradition in Australia that has that as part of its culture, I think is a really, really beautiful thing. Building upon that theme of elders then, I think it's important to remember that the gestures help build connection and that moments of disconnection are inevitable. And I think it's important that we see those as the life cycles of the teacher-student relationship within our times in the schools. And whenever possible, reach out, clip on, as we would say here at Crescent, but, you know, reach out to people who may have a positive connection with that student to seek to learn, to understand the angle to which they are intersecting and breaking through whatever barriers that you might be finding. That's an important professional commitment and awareness to who we are as teachers and to understand that we are part of a learning community. I think employing that gesture of storytelling and sharing personal moments of vulnerability are really important ways to get our boys connected to us on a level that is beyond academic assessment or curricular instruction. It doesn't have to be a weakness, but like, I'm not good at public speaking, I see that you are, that kind of thing, but it just could be a love of animals or camping or whatever it happens to be. Just saying, beyond the school setting, we are people and we share things in common. I think we can easily fall into the trap or make the mistake that after one or two gestures at the beginning of the year, things should be all tickety-boo and fine. And in fact, I think it's important that remember that the relational journey is a relational journey, and it doesn't stop with one or two moments at the beginning of the year. It needs to be regenerated, and you know, you need to put that passion and that connection all the way through your time with that student. So it's an organic relational experience. And I think that that just understanding that it's more than one or two things and knowing that you're in it for the long haul is a really important thing for us to keep top of mind. So, you know, I'm going to conclude with that notion of presence. Sometimes being there is all a student needs to understand your commitment to them and their journey as a young boy or teacher of young adults. And you mentioned this earlier, Peter, you know, attending the play they're in, watching that game from the sidelines, they see you and they feel that. It's a gesture without words, but it shows that they matter to you because you showed up for them. And inevitably, I believe that they will show up for us.
Wow. What a conversation. So many nuggets, so much to think about. And I think so much advice for people to walk away with. So I know, Sandy, it's early morning for you. Peter, it's end of the workday for you in the evening already. I value the time that you've given to share your expertise. And thank you for participating in the conversation today.
A pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Bruce. I always enjoy speaking with you and to share that time with my long-term partner in crime, Dr. Sandra Boyes, is a special pleasure. So thank you.
I'm sure that, like me, you're leaving this conversation with a deeper understanding of the profound impact of strong teacher-student relationships in boys' education. Sandy and Peter's insights into relational learning highlight the importance of genuine connection, creating a supportive classroom environment, and fostering a school culture that values these bonds. By prioritizing these elements, educators can empower boys to thrive academically and personally. Until our next episode, keep on championing boys' education.